Across the landscape of American agriculture, one can see where there were many, there are now few. What we see leads us to ask, is it better to have a few big farms or many small farms?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with your host, Michael Olson. And now get ready for 1 hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Hello out there. You are tuned into the 1361st edition of the Food Chain Radio Show and podcast. Or hey, perhaps you're among our friends way up there in Aberdeen who are tuned into the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com. Whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What. Folks, I once had the opportunity to broadcast a Food Chain Radio Show from the Phil and Barbara Hamburger Farm in Seneca, South Dakota. The Hamburgers were farming corn, soy, and wheat on 10,000 acres of land. And their second floor farm office reminded me of the bridge of an aircraft carrier as it looked out over what seemed to be an endless ocean of green. We talked about the economies that forced the Hamburgers to either get big or get out of the business of farming. After the show was over and the pleasantries exchanged, I headed out on the highway that led me into the little town of Seneca. By then it was mid-afternoon, and being a bit hungry, I stopped at a Crazy Days stand where Cub Scouts were selling hot dogs. I asked the Scouts how their hot dog business was doing, and they said, "You're the only customer we've had so far." Fact is, there are no longer enough people left in many of the heartland small towns to keep Cub Scout hot dog stands in business anymore. Thinking back to the Hamburgers Farm and the Scouts hot dogs, I wonder, is America better off having few big farms or many small farms? Who better to ask than an author of a book on the very big of American agriculture, and he is Austin Frerich, who is the author of Barons, Money, Power, and the Corruption of America's Food Industry. Austin, welcome to the Food Chain.
Thanks for having me on, Michael.
Pleasure to have you aboard. You're an exciting guy. My goodness, in the last presidential election, you were advising Elizabeth Warren, Bernie Sanders, Pete Buttigieg, and President Biden on agricultural policies, and you're at Yale University now, collaborating on research for competition policy and antitrust enforcement. How on earth did an Iowa boy get connected with all of this agriculture?
To be fair, Iowa is agriculture what Hollywood is to movies. It's just painted into it. I'm from Cedar Rapids, urban Iowa, but even that, in the day, my town's a corn town. Your fruit roll-up, your Cheerios, your Captain Crunch, your Aunt Jemima syrup is all made in this town. And it's more than just a farmer. It's people like my mom who ran a bakery. It's people like my dad's an ethanol truck driver. So it's all just there.
It's all there. As you say, it's baked into the people of Iowa. You are the heart of the heartland, as a matter of fact. The interesting thing about your work is that you seem to have taken what at one time in American history would have been great success stories and turn them upside down by using the word barons. Now, where did you come up with the notion of using barons to describe these people who have achieved what some would say is great success in the industry of agriculture?
Because let me start by saying I really do think we're living in another gilded age. Such a have-not moment where you just see, take rural America. So much rural America is producing the most wealth it's ever produced, but none of this wealth is staying there. I almost view a lot of rural America as an extraction colony at this point. What used to be middle-class family farms have now collapsed. Now a lot of people are just low-wage workers for these robber barons. And there's this whole notion that there's this false premise that, oh, they got big because of the most efficient, most technologically advanced. And what you realize is there's a whole undercurrent of regulatory capture, corners being cut. And like my real big takeaway is you become a robber baron because you're willing to cross lines others aren't willing to cross, ethical lines. Like most hog farmers weren't willing to shove their pigs into a metal shed.
It certainly wasn't the way my grandfather ran his farm, that's for sure. And because the pigs were in a pen and having a very sociable life of it as long as it lasted. And they're not quite that free anymore, that's for sure. And which is really what you're getting at here. We've really changed the nature of agriculture from that Jeffersonian ideal to this almost totalitarian regime when it gets right down to it.
When you think of what is even a farmer anymore, my dairy baron pretends to be a farmer. He cosplays at it. He's been on dirty jobs. But I discovered he secretly lives at the Ritz-Carlton in Puerto Rico because if you live in Puerto Rico, you don't have to pay capital income taxes. And he filed a PPE loan and he claimed over 100 employees. Most dairy farms at this point are run by undocumented men. And so who's the farmer? Is he the farmer? No, I would argue he's a capital asset manager. The real farmers are those undocumented workers throughout the food system. Mm-hmm. And even to like the way you frame this conversation, I think is fascinating because it's not even a conversation between small farms and these robber barons. It's really what happened. It's reflecting the bigger American economy of the collapse of the middle, family farm. Those are the people that have been really hollowed out the most.
And with them being hollowed out, so too was the heartland of the nation.
Yeah. And the politics of rage filled the void.
How did that become manifest from your perspective when you look at Iowa?
That's how it got me, this whole thing started. I kid you not, I was in a dive bar in Des Moines, Iowa. There was a big governor's race in 2018, and I didn't know this at the time, but Iowa doesn't have campaign contribution limits. So this political person was telling me how the largest donor in the state was this hog baron. Hog farmer had given over $300,000 to the governor. He had a private home in the only gated community in the suburbs of Des Moines, had a home in Naples, Florida, and he flew back and forth between the two on his private jet. And so that's what I was like, well, first of all, that's good copy. But second, how did this happen? And then it was digging into it where you realize the regulatory capture, where let's just start off with the fact that if you treat hog manure like human manure, keep in mind these animals defecate three times more than us. This model is not economical. No city would pool its manure in these massive ponds that occasionally leak. These facilities that these animals live in, there's no air regulations on them, even though they put off tons of toxic gases. You see these terrific, horrific accidents in the Midwest every few months where a worker goes in, door shuts on them, you're a goner. Because usually what happens is the fumes knock you out and you fall into the lagoon and drown to death. So you just have all this going on. And that's why my hog baron gives money to the governor. He's buying her off. Because his whole business model is predicated on us paying for the consequences of his business model.
And how did that change the landscape of Iowa? When you drive across the countryside, what do you see that's different?
The countryside is no longer the countryside. It's almost like the one big New Jersey turnpike. It's incredibly industrial. It's really barren. It's devoid of life. You don't see animals. Even when I drove 6 hours from Sioux City on the west part of Iowa yesterday to Cedar Rapids, and you can count on one or two hands how many cattle. And those are disappearing too now. Everything else has been put into these metal sheds. So it's just you just have tons of corn and soy being produced everywhere to feed these animals inside the metal sheds or to be burned in our cars. And it's what used to be, if you visit a family farm, like dairy, cows on land, that farmer had a relationship with the animal. They know their personalities. They'll tell you everything about it. When you put these animals in the shed like this, they become another animal, another thing on an Excel sheet. You lose that humanity. And then you hire a bunch of low-wage workers, basically come in once a day and haul out the dead bodies. So if you drive rural Iowa now, next to every one of these confinements, you'll see a dumpster full of, you know, bloated dead animal bodies.
Wow.
It's graphic stuff. My goal of my book is, let's not romanticize. This is what the food system is. And this is why a lot of people are angry. But also we got to have an honest conversation of what we are, like what's happened in order to reform it. Mm-hmm.
People often talk about the industrialization of agriculture. And that's really what you're describing here, is it not? Farms have become factories.
Yes. Factories, corporations, it's and the risk has been shifted onto other people. And the burden's been pushed onto other people. And the gain's been concentrated by a few.
And how do they do the shifting of the risk?
You know what's funny is, I kid you not, Michael, it all starts with chicken. A century ago after the jungle, when we wrote all these meat regulations.
The jungle being Upton Sinclair's story, correct?
Correct. You just had, Teddy Roosevelt took an issue in the meat beef trust. So Congress passed like the Packer and Stock Security Act and a few other things, but they didn't write chicken into the regulation because there's no commercial chicken slaughterhouses. It was just you had a chicken in your backyard, you butcher it when you wanted it, and that was it. So what happened down south was corporations saw that model of sharecropping, that really exploitive model that really hurt black farmers, and applied it to chicken. So if you're a chicken farmer in America to this day, you're given the bird, you're given the feed, you basically babysit the bird, you never own it, you take on a lot of debt to build these certain metal sheds through the company's specifications, you sell the bird back to the company, or you give the bird back to the company, they weigh it in a room you cannot see, you're paid in a tournament system, so whoever adds the most gets paid the most, but if I don't like you, I give you the runt, so you get paid the least, and you go broke because you have all this debt over you. And it's why it's an old stat, like 70% of chicken farmers in America are in poverty. So you have this incredibly exploitive production model. What happens is it makes chicken cheap. And so chicken gets a lot of market share, but instead of making chicken behave like the other meat.
So where chickens used to live out in the yard, as they did on my grandparents' place, they no longer live outside where they get fresh air and real food to eat.
Yeah, you see what happened and started down south where corporations took that model of sharecropping that was really exploitive to black farmers and applied it to chickens. So if you're a modern day chicken farmer in America, you're given the bird, you're given the feed. You never own the animal, you babysit it. You take on a ton of debt to build these metal sheds to the company's specifications. You then give the bird back to the company. They wait in a room you cannot see. Whoever adds most gets paid the most, adds the least gets paid the least. And it's incredibly exploitive, and it's an old stat that 70% chicken farmers live in poverty. And what you've seen is chicken got a lot of market share. Instead of USDA, instead of making chicken behave like the other meats, it's engaged in a race to the bottom. And so to me, you see this incredibly exploitive production model replicate across the food system.
And thus you point to those who have achieved great success in the chicken business. And you turn that upside down and say, maybe they're not so successful. Maybe they're exploitative. Maybe they're just like the robber barons of old. And so you list a few of them, a number of them, five or six of them. And one of them is close to home here in coastal California.
Yeah.
And so we're going to pick up that baron of berries. When we come back from this break, folks, this is the Food Chain Radio program. Michael Olson with Austin Frerich, who is the author of Barons, Money, Power, and the Corruption of America's Food Industry.
Let's go back for more of What's Eating What on the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
What was considered to be a great success is now being looked at in an entirely different light by the author of Barons, Money, Power, and the Corruption of America's Food Industry. He is Austin Frerich, an Iowa boy, gone to Washington, D.C., and advising the political elite of the Democratic Party, at least, how to proceed with agriculture that is perhaps a little more humane than the industrial models now being put forth throughout our land. Austin, you've come up with an incredible story of how some people in agriculture have become immensely successful, and I guess it would be cornering the market. Is that still a fair expression that you would?
Oh, yeah. Never forget, Michael, I had such an aha moment a few years ago where the goal of any corporate executive is monopoly. That's where profit is. And so your goal is to corner the market. And so you have a fundamental tension between business wanting cornering the market and government not, because it stifles innovation, it hurts workers, it hurts farmers. Okay. And I just think we're at a moment where things have shifted so far one way.
Some years ago, I authored a book entitled Metro Farm. It's a guide to growing for profit in or near the city for the city. And I realized that all metropolitan farmers are in essence in competition with Goliaths of agriculture. As competitor, you must realize where the strengths lie in being big. And to me, one of the biggest strengths of being very big is having the economies of scale sufficient to be able to buy government influence.
Yep.
And so it almost seems to me that the bigger you get, the bigger you want the government to be, because the more power the government has, the more you can use it, use government to influence policy. Now,
100%. That is, it's power. It reinforces itself once it gets going.
And once it gets going, how do you stop it?
That's why I intentionally use this robber baron framework. Is we've been here before. It was that last Gilded Age that ushered in a reform movement. And that's what I hope here is these guys are, first of all, they go too far. They get too greedy. Then also they're just, people get sick of it. That to me is the most shocking thing of it since I published my book is just how many different pockets of America it's connected with. The grocery store alone, when markets are concentrated, you're going to be gouged and
you're going to be owned.
You're going to be owned, and you have wild things now where you have barons fighting barons. Walmart's making a massive vertical play into dairy and beef production because it got sick of being screwed, shortchanged by my other barons. And that this is just where we are right now.
And, of course, Walmart is one of the barons that you hold up for scrutiny. And how one family really is taking over a huge chunk of the American grocery business. And that's what Walmart is, essentially. It's a grocery store, a giant one, a huge one.
Yeah. Isn't that, and you know what's funny is I didn't plan to include them. I wanted to talk about grocery, but I never thought of Walmart as a grocery store. And I've been to Walmart tons of times. But you're right, 60% of their sales comes from grocery. And their market share in grocery is something we've never seen before, where it's the same as the second, third, fourth, fifth, sixth, and seventh competitor combined.
If you're a chicken farmer and you're trying to sell chickens to Walmart, chances are you don't have much bargaining power there.
That's why they call it in the grocery industry the supply and command. I would argue Walmart's the closest thing we've ever had in America to a Soviet Union-style Politburo. The power is so shifted one way. And keep in mind, we used to have a whole regulatory framework that prevented this kind of thing from happening. It comes out of a Texas congressman named Rob Patman that prevented a lot of this power from getting so one-sided. But as we saw in the 80s, a lot of the regulatory framework was thrown away.
And it would be my thought that, again, as I said, the bigger you get, the stronger you want the government to be, because then the more control you have over those who might be in the have a mind to compete with you. But speaking of Southern models, you hold up the Driscoll Company as being an example of the Southern model of almost out of the slavery ages. How does that work?
I mean, that's most wild. I mean, that is, I first started writing about Driscolls because I really wanted to talk about how all these trade agreements have really shifted a lot of our anything that's labor intensive in the food system has moved offshore. And I wanted to tell that story.
Mm-hmm.
But then when I realized I was diving into Driscolls, it's like they grow one in three berries, but they don't grow a single berry. They own the IP of the thing, but they took that model of chicken production, applied it to berries. So they have others do their growing, because growing of the actual thing is the most risky part. But that way they can also shortchange labor, evade environmental regulations, and then Driscolls can play ignorant. Oh, we didn't know 12-year-olds were picking berries. And so now you have berries. Driscolls grows berries on every continent in the world now, except Antarctica.
And what makes the Driscoll model so onerous? Because it just in being in such close proximity to the Driscoll Company and to the people who work there, I tell you, I got to admire the ingenuity in what they have set up. It seems to me a great piece of business genius.
That's the weird thing to say, Michael, where two things can be true at once, where, I mean, you cannot help admire some of these barons, what they did. I mean, they were, to give the brothers credit, they saw the rise of Walmart coming back in the 80s. They realized one company wants four berries year-round for 4,000 stores. So they created this production system. But, I mean, to me, the best little example of just what it means is in your area, there's been a lot of farm workers in the Watsonville area, say, because they grow berries right up to the schools,
mm-hmm.
and elementary schools. And they asked Driscoll's, please stop doing – you can grow berries, but please do organics. Please stop spraying all these pesticides and chemicals near where our kids play in the playground. And what did Driscoll's do? Oh, we can't do anything. Our berry growers do whatever they want. And that's just a bald-faced lie. You have so much market power you can tell them, do organics next to schools, but they don't. It's this whole evading of responsibility. It's incredibly exploitive and just shifting of responsibility where you want all the benefits and shifting all the dark stuff into other people so you can play the ignorant.
Let's back up a little bit and describe the model that Driscoll's has adopted, because when you think about it, it is pretty clever. They don't grow strawberries or any berries. They have other people do the growing for them. What Driscoll does is that it controls the genetics.
Yep.
So they license the genetics of the berries to other growers, to its growers, who must then grow the berries in accordance with the Driscoll way of growing berries. What Driscoll wants is uniformity across their berry line. So when they do go to somebody like Walmart and say, yes, we can provide you with strawberries 12 months of the year, and they're all going to be Driscoll berries, which is to say they're all going to be just like the next berry. So they're going to be uniform. And when you're in a big shopping environment like Walmart, you have to have that uniformity and predictability. And that's what Driscoll is able to do by not growing berries. Is that a fair representation?
100%. And they did something weird too, is you don't really see that many brands in the fruit and veggie area. It's no one can name a pear brand, but they also spent a lot of money on marketing. When you say Driscoll's, everyone in America knows what that is.
And therefore that is not only did they own the genetics, but then they own the name Driscoll's too. So it's almost synonymous with strawberries. So yeah. People say, I'm going to have some Driscoll's, and everybody would know what that would mean, which is, in terms of business, a genius thing to do. What made that possible for them to do that? And somebody that grows almonds, for example, would never be able to do that.
It's what allowed them partly to do. Keep in mind, those almonds are very cattle intensive. That's why, to me, so much of California agricultural system in the last few decades has shifted into nuts, because you don't need a lot of farm labor.
Right.
And so that's why Driscoll's has moved a lot of berry production, like to Baja. So like where they produce in Baja, that area is just as dry as Death Valley. It's 3 inches of water. It was very empty. So they brought in indigenous workers. They drained the aquifers. They built desalinization plants. But keep in mind, these are almost like modern day plantations. That's aggressive rhetoric to use. But it's so, you see reports here and there. The LA Times did a great series a few years ago just on how exploitive these labor conditions are. But as these supply chains get longer, the transparency collapse, especially with the state of American media, and especially in a place like Mexico.
And one of the things that makes this area in particular so attractive for companies like Driscoll's is that we have the climate is so unique that it could be cool here in the middle of a hot summer, which mm-hmm. is perfect for delicate things like berries and salad things. Now, Driscoll's also doing something that, to me, looks even more genius than anything else they've done before, and that's taking the strawberry plant out of the ground and moving it to Virginia.
Yeah, the whole vertical farming thing, the indoor farming mm-hmm. thing. That's
What exactly are they doing there?
You're seeing tons of Silicon Valley capital. And also, Driscoll's is very much a Silicon Valley type company. It's the same thing as Apple, where Apple owns the IP. They have other people make the iPhones, and then you sell it for a premium in America. They're doing it in these massive warehouses. They're having people grow, you know, berries in, you know, these soilless environments because, you know, for shipping costs.
And labor costs too.
Labor costs.
Because you don't have to stoop.
You know, yeah, that's a very good point, because farm workers, strawberries are the ones they hate the most. They're known as fruit of the devil, just because it destroys your back. All that bending to get down and get them. And they're trying to do robots for it, but it's incredibly hard, as you said, because berries are so fickle. But keep in mind, this indoor berry production they're trying on the East Coast, that's incredibly energy intensive to do that much heating, that much stuff to like, you know,
sure,
get the berries.
Sure, you have to control everything. You have to be God of nature, the nature of a warehouse, to be able to do this successfully and have the berries come out tasting decently. But the future, if they can pull this off, looks very promising for taking the food out of the ground and being able to grow it in factory warehouses, which would be a further industrialization of the processes that you talk about for hogs and chickens and everything else, right?
Oh, totally. And then keep in mind, too, like what's lost in this whole thing is taste. That berry looks beautiful, but the berry just doesn't have any flavor anymore compared to like a backyard strawberry. This industrial model is all about durability and transportation. It doesn't really care about taste. Like even right in my book, I have a dairy barn, and so I would do milk tastings, and the inputs of a cow matter. Cows that run around in pasture are going to make a much better breast milk than an animal that's in a metal shed all day eating corn.
But in looking at Driscoll from a very short distance, I do admire the business acumen. What about Driscoll's do you hold up as being bad, as that makes them a baron, a robber baron?
It's an empire built on exploiting labor. Here's the mind. When you engage in this production model, you're undermining any berry producer doing it right in America. And especially you're undermining the gains of farm workers in California, because you cannot compete on price against children picking berries in developing countries. You just can't. And that's, to me, the big undercurrent of that chapter is not only that, but also the water. They're not along the California coast. They're having to pull from aquifers. Given when berries are growing, there's very little rainfall. And so those aquifers are being drained. Even around their headquarters in Watsonville, the waterways are all polluted because this toxic, you have a lot of chemicals necessary for berry production. And so it's just one of those things where, sure, I can admire, you can admire what someone built, but you can also be very conscious of just how destructive their empire, like who they trampled on in order to build that empire.
Okay, that's fair enough. And yet, I see a lot of happy berry pickers. I know that it might be hard to imagine that people who pick berries for a living would find it a happy existence doing so. But I see a lot of them in the fields. And as a matter of fact, a few years ago, I was driving through Watsonville, and I happened to notice the red flags waving in a farm equipment facility. So I thought, oh, it looks like the UFW is back to raising a strike or something. So I swung in and got my recorder out to get some sound, and I asked who's in charge, and everybody looked nervously at each other. And finally, I realized that the people demonstrating were demonstrating against being part of the union. They didn't want anything to do with being part of the United Farm Workers Union. And so it's really a complex issue, the labor there. A lot of people are earning enough to get by in a very expensive world that we have here in California. So you got to wonder, it's not all bad the way they're doing things. Now, my whole thing is, how can a small farmer go up against that kind of business and compete and survive? This is the Food Chain, Michael Olson. We're going to take another quick break, but when we come back, we have a lot of other barons to look at, and we have Austin Frerich, who's going to bring them to you, and they're very interesting stories, so do stay tuned. Right back.
So much to say, so little time to say it, on the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Yes, very little time to talk about it, and there's so much to talk about. Austin Frerich has made the case that those who have achieved immense success in America's agriculture and our food chain in general often did by exploiting and running roughshod over everybody else. Is that a fair summation, Austin?
Yeah, I think so.
Okay, fair enough. And that's the way they've always done it, it seems, is that eating the little ones.
I think meatpacking is a really good industry to study of.
Let's look at meatpacking, exactly.
Yeah, because what we saw was we made a choice as a society after Upton Sinclair wrote The Jungle of not to let workers be exploited like this. So we elevated that low-wage occupation to a solid middle-class job. People like my grandfather worked in a slaughterhouse, was able to raise a family, buy a home. And what we've seen is a systematic assault on that industry by corporate America to reverse it back to its low-wage origins. So now the point we have children working in slaughterhouses again overnight, and nothing's being done about it. And you're also being gouged in the store. Ranchers are being underpaid. And what's wild about Mike Slaughtering Baron, JBS, is they pled guilty to bribing their way to monopoly level status. They bribed over 1,800 Brazilian politicians.
Now back up a little bit and tell us about who we're talking about now.
JBS. So JBS is this company originally from Brazil. They entered the American meat markets, I want to say like 2005. And through their bribery, they got a lot of cheap money to buy a ton of companies.
So that harkens back to what we were talking about earlier. Those who are big enough to enjoy the economies of scale sufficient to be able to influence government can do a lot of things the rest of us who don't have those economies of scale can do. And so they had the economies of scale to buy the government. You call them bribes. I guess there are a lot of different names for them. Campaign contributions, bribes.
No, these are straight up bribes. These weren't campaign contributions. They admitted to bribery, like hard stop period. They are the closest thing we have in modern day America to a criminal organization operating as a corporation. Like, they admitted to bribing, literally bribing a politician with a $1 million Manhattan apartment. This is not campaign contributions. This is old-fashioned bribery. I want to be very clear on that because it's so insane. And I think it was lost in the news because this deal, when they pled guilty, happened right before the 2020 election. I study meat for a living. I wasn't even aware of it, Michael. That's what's wild to me is writing this chapter, I just get angry because it's just the corruption is just rampant in that space.
Who has heard of JBS? Not many people have heard.
No, because they have 40 brands in America, but not one of their brands is JBS. So you would never know you'd buy one of their products at the store. That is the scary thing of this moment is this illusion of choice. You see all these different brands, but what's really going on is they're for different price points. So that yuppie consumer wants to think they're getting a different ham product than the lower income consumer, even though it's the same commodity ham.
Wow. And so they bought a bunch of other companies, amassed them under their JBS umbrella under different names, and in doing so gained immense control over the industry of slaughtering animals. And you say that whereas the industry once had higher priced labor, why we were actually happy to pay our slaughterers to do the dirty work for us, that is changing. How are people like JBS changing the labor structure of the slaughter industry?
The big thing what happened is it started by the shifting of meat production from urban America to rural America. And by doing that, especially during the farm crisis, you had surplus labor. They were desperate for jobs. And then they attacked and broke the unions. And then a lot of these slaughterhouses, usually immigrant workers, they're on some sort of indentured servitude visa program. And so they have this very marginal position of power. And so you just see these companies have so much power over the workers and just exploit it any means necessary. And that to me is, it was so clearly evident during COVID, the way they treated the workers is they did not really care. They treated them like the animals on the kill line.
You talked about indentured servitude contracts.
Yes.
What is that?
That's what they, so to me, the hallmark of this era is so much language is designed to hide what's happening and keep people out. So in the food industry, they're called H-2A visas, these agricultural visa programs. But to me, they're just, oh, this is just indentured servitude. That is what a former congressman in New York City called them. That's intentional by industry to hide what they're doing is your employment in America is only allowed for as long as the company is sponsoring you. So they have power over you, control, and they have no qualms over exercising over you if you're not behaving well.
Okay. So they come in under contract to a company. The company, therefore, owns them to the extent that if you don't do what we want, we fire you and you no longer have this contract. But
yeah.
That doesn't seem to mean anything anymore because people just wander off and find another job because labor's short and there's lots of work for everybody, it seems. Now,
So industry wants that because, let's be honest, a lot of these industries hire undocumented workers. It's rampant, especially in the dairy industry. They want this program so they can have the veneer of legitimacy. So they can be like, oh, we didn't know, you know what I mean? And then it also gives them a little bit more control over their employees. So you're right, they can easily hire undocumented workers, but they want that veneer to hide behind, because back in the George Bush administration, you would occasionally see these acts by George Bush to, they would round up a slaughterhouse town. They would deport 300 workers. And industry didn't like it because these kill lines are so fragile. They have to keep moving because they're so concentrated, where if you stop the kill line for a second, you have a massive backlog.
It's hard for people to imagine what you say by kill line. How many animals do these slaughterhouses kill in a day and process? Do you have any idea?
Man. Not off the top of my head. In my book, I reference it. The chicken, it's all about, it really depends on the speed of the kill line. Most of these slaughterhouses are doing three shifts. That's also been a big goal of the industry, is to speed up the kill lines. The Trump administration just took off the guardrails. They wanted to go as fast as possible. And then I compare Secretary Vilsack under Biden to like Harold Hill of The Music Man. He says the right things, but he doesn't mean anything he says. And so he's been trying to speed up the kill lines too, especially in pork for the industry, because at some point you have fixed capital assets for what you've spent for the manufacturing stuff, but it's the more product you can kill and move, the better. And also, so what if these are dangerous jobs? You can just find a new worker. It's very, in these states, that's why you're seeing them push allowing children to work in these slaughterhouses. Now, that was a goal of the governor of Iowa this past session.
So we have a situation where it's not a very enjoyable job, but it's a job, and it was a good-paying job. Now, let me ask you about, with respect to labor, it seems like the federal government has opened up the floodgates for any and all to come in, no questions asked. Is that about labor on these industrial farms? Is that what we see happening here? Is that it's ollie oxen free for anybody who wants to work on these farms?
I'm a believer that nothing will change until you start actually just arresting these employers. Right now, we just blame the workers, and that's until you deal with the dairy baron. When, first of all, keep in mind, the family dairy farm is not engaging in these practices. They're doing it themselves. But so they're, first of all, they're losing, they're going bankrupt because they can't compete against someone.
They can't compete against, yeah.
Yeah. And then these guys, my favorite is my dairy baron. He gave President Trump massive amount of campaign contributions in 2016. But his whole empire is built on, I discovered writing this book that an undocumented worker died on his farm, died in one of his industrial hog manure pits. This man had three children left behind. It was hidden, was never reported, and he just had to pay a $10,000 fine.
People die on farms a lot because it's a very dangerous business when it gets right down
people
to it.
People don't die in manure pools on
manure
pasture
pools,
dairy
yeah. And it's really hard for anyone who lives in the city to imagine the terror of those industrial hog farms when it gets right down to it. And that's why they're probably the reason they're covered up. And we've actually done programs wherein people fight about the right to see what's going on in those programs. And perhaps if that was the case, if everybody in the city saw what was happening with respect to the food that they get at Walmart or wherever, maybe that would change something.
My big goal, though, is I also want to be very conscious of, so many people are barely getting by right now. Consumer choice will not lead us to reforms we need. Using your fork to buy better food will not create systemic change. What tends to happen is people doing it right, the boys either push you out of business through business practices, mm-hmm. or they buy you up. We need to change structures. The thing about take meat, we know what to do here. We did it a century ago. The question now is just political courage to do the right
thing. What did we do a century ago?
We broke up the meat companies. And a simple thing of, you realize, take JBS. First of all, you should not be allowed to keep your meat empire if you bought all these companies through bribery. Let's just start there. Like, you should unwind.
So if you're breaking the law, you should not benefit from breaking the law.
Yeah, exactly. What a radical concept. That is like two things to always keep in mind in this book is the system we have now is radical. So many of the changes we're talking about, reforms, are very traditional. And then even a simple thing in the meat industry, for example, in Iowa, we have a law in the book we just don't enforce called a packer ban, where a company cannot own an animal. It slaughters. So if you enforce that rule, you'd break up most of the meat companies because most of them own a large chunk of their animals at this point. So we could do a national version of that. Smithfield, the largest butcher of hogs in America, is also the largest owner of hogs.
Which is also a Chinese company.
Yep.
Which is connected with the Chinese Communist Party. as well, which is another story entirely. But they are the biggest processor of hogs in the country, and probably the world, but it gets right down to it.
Yeah. I mean, what's wild about even them is we're not eating more. Pork consumption in America is pretty flat, but we're producing more and more hogs, and it's for export mainly to China and other Southeast Asian countries. And so essentially we are destroying rural Iowa to feed China.
Yeah.
Like waterways in Iowa are an open sewer. Like that is the consequence of this power is 60 to 70% of the waterways in Iowa are too toxic now.
Austin Frerich, you're advising the monkey mucks in the Democrat Party, at least, on how to contend with antitrust issues. And what we're seeing, what you're pointing out with Barron's, is there is an antitrust issue to deal with. So what are you telling our leaders to do?
Let me also just say, too, I'm having a lot of success in the Republican world, too. A lot of this book were based on ideas I wrote in the American Conservative, because I'm a big believer in that the most meaningful reforms in America happen when you have weird bedfellows come together. And I think meat packing is one of them. So my big thing, besides dealing with the concentration of the meat industry, is putting animals back on the land. I just think this industrial model of meat and dairy production is just awful.
And I can see how that would appeal to conservatives and liberals alike when it gets right down to it.
It's pro-farmer. I want more farmers. And what's, to me, the silver lining of this moment is people don't realize, but the largest use of corn now in America is ethanol. And ethanol is going to die. Cars are moving to EVs and hybrids, and that market will collapse, and it'll collapse fast. And you're going to have all this idle former corn land. But to me, that's the perfect moment to phase out one model and phase in this old model. Phase back this old model.
When I discuss ways to compete with those who have the economies of scale for small farmers, the principal way to win that competition for small people is to stop big people from buying government. And I believe if everything cost what it really costs, then the small farms would be far more productive than the industrial farms. But how does one stop buying the government? Those who have the economies of scale, how can you stop them from buying the government? Because they always get the government to subsidize their way of doing things. And whenever you subsidize something, you distort its value.
That's why my favorite little nugget is the only farmer in the free market is the farmer's market farmer. They're not getting into the farm bill stuff. It's these barons, these large corporate entities that's where all the money's going to. Everything you eat is subsidized. The question is to what degree?
Yes, except for those who grow for the farmer's markets.
Yeah, that's why to me you do two things at once. You both attack the current system, you know, come on, like the fact that there's a berry baron is so cartoonish and it's morally outrageous. You have a dairy farmer living at the Ritz-Carlton. So you do that, but at the same time too, you need to allow a new system to emerge. And for like me, I always tell people, cause people always ask me, what can I do? And I always say the best thing you can do is procurement. Pair that local farmer up with, help them get a contract for a local school or college. Because a lot of them will tell you, they don't like the farmer's market. They get rained out. It's not consistent. You get that contract from your local school.
And there you got it.
Yeah.
Brother, we're out of time, Austin, but we're not out of ideas. And I like your idea about pairing farmers with people.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with Michael Olson. And if your friends missed the show, tell them to log on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com for a listen. Now, go out and find some food with its farmer's face on it and live.